distance and the Nightbringer. I crossed the Empire and broke into Koth prison. I rescued my brother and hundreds of other scholars. I am not nothing. I turn to the king now. If you do not prepare for war, your grace, and the Nightbringer unleashes his djinn, we will all fall. And how do we do that, Lyre of Sarah, without Serik Steel? Princess Nikla says. We know your brother still lives. Musa no doubt has him hidden away, hammering at weapons for your resistance.
Darin of Sarah is willing to make weaponry for the mariners, Musa cuts in smoothly, and I wonder when he talked to Darin about it. And to teach mariner smiths the trade. If an equal amount of weaponry is given to the scholars and an equal number of scholar smiths are taught, and if the scholars who have lost their homes are given temporary quarters in the city and employment.
Lies, Nikla hisses. Father, they seek to mislead you. They want only to arm their resistance. As much as I want to talk back, I make myself ignore Nikla. It's the king whom I must convince. Your Majesty, I say, it's a good offer. You won't get a better one. The Marshals certainly aren't going to help you, and how else will you get Serik Steel? The king observes me carefully now, and the sparkle of amusement in his eyes is gone.
You are bold, Lyre of Sarah, to tell a king what to do.
Not bold, I say. Just desperate and sick of seeing my people suffer.
I hear truth in your words, girl. And yet,
the king looks to his daughter, whereas without the ghouls she looked regal, even beautiful. Now she looks angry and merciless, her lips leached of color, her pupils overly bright. The old man shakes his head.
Perhaps what you say is true, the king says. But if we arm ourselves with Serik's deal, prepare our fleets, ready our defenses, the marshals could declare war by claiming we are planning an attack.
The marshals are in a constant state of readiness, I say. They can't attack you just because you do the same.
I hear his age in his sigh. Oh, child, he says. Do you have any idea of the dance the mariners have been forced into these past 500 years? With the Empire snapping at our borders? Do you know how difficult that dance has grown with scholars pouring into our country? I am old. Soon I will die. What do I leave my daughter? Tens of thousands of refugees? The great library destroyed? A people divided, half wishing to help the scholars, the other half tired from 500 years of doing so. And I am to muster my armies. On the word of a girl who has apparently been helping to make illegal weaponry.
At least help the scholars from the refugee camp, I say.
We will replace their tents. In time. That is all we can do.
Father, Nikla says, I request to take this girl and her brother, who is no doubt lurking in the city, into custody.
No,
King Emon says, and though his words are laden with the authority of his office, I notice with a chill that his hands, spotted and shaking with palsy, give away his immense age. Soon enough, his daughter will be queen.
If we keep them here, daughter, we give the marshals cause to question our commitments to peace. They are fugitives in the Empire, are they not?
Sir, I say, please listen. You were friends with my mother. You trusted her. Please, in her place, trust me now.
It was an honor to meet a daughter of Mira's. We had our differences, your mother and I have heard wretched rumors about her over the years. But her heart was true. Of that I am certain. In honor of our friendship, I give you and your brother 2 days to leave the city. Captain Aliba will oversee your preparations and your departure. Musa, the king shakes his head. Do not return here again. The king reaches a hand out to the captain of his city guard. She clasps it immediately, steadying him as he stands.
See that Laya of Sarah and her brother find their way to the docks, captain. I have a kingdom to run.
Chapter 33. The Bloodshrike. I cannot celebrate the fact that I have saved Livia and thus thwarted the commandant. Marcus knows now what I can do, and though he said little after discovering me, it is only a matter of time before he uses the knowledge against me. But worse than that is the fact that within days of arriving in Antium, I learn that Carus has managed to procure her freedom.
The illustrian Pater's discovered a bleeding loophole.
Marcus paces in his private study, boots crunching against the shattered remnants of a table he destroyed in a fit of rage.
It doesn't allow the head of an illustrian gens to be imprisoned for longer than a week without the approval of 2/3 of the other illustrian gens.
But she's not mater of gens, Veturia.
She was when you threw her in jail, Marcus says. Apparently that's what matters.
She let thousands die in Navium.
Skies, you are stupid, Marcus groans. Navium is 1,000 leagues away. The illustrians and Mercators there can do nothing to help us. They couldn't even keep her locked up. Her allies in Antium are already spreading some ridiculous story about how she wasn't to blame in Navium. Would that I could lop all their heads off.
He cocks his head, muttering.
Cut off one and 12 more appear in their place. I know, I know.
Bleeding skies. He's talking to his brother's ghost again. I wait for him to stop, and when he doesn't, I back away, willing him not to notice and closing the door quietly behind me. Harper waits outside, fidgeting at the mutters coming from the study. Carus will be here in a little more than 2 weeks, I say, as we emerge into the noon sunshine. And all the more dangerous for the time she spent in a cage. I glance back at the palace. Marcus is spending more time talking to his brother's ghost, Harper. The moment Carus gets here, she'll try to take advantage of it. Get a message to Dex. My friend remained in Navium to help oversee the rebuilding of the destroyed parts of the city. Tell him to get eyes on her, and tell him I need him back here as soon as possible. An hour later, Harper finds me pacing in my study, and we set to work. The plebeians are suspicious of Carus after what happened in Navium, I say. Now we have to destroy the illustrians' confidence in her.
We go after a character, Avitas says. Most of the illustrian Paetis are classist. None of her allies nor Elias's father was a plebeian. Release the information.
It's not enough, I say. It was years ago. And Elias is long gone, but, I consider, what about her do we not know? What are her secrets? That tattoo of hers, did she ever tell you anything about it when you were working with her?
Harper shakes his head. All I know is that it was first spotted on her nearly 2 decades ago, a year or so after she abandoned Elias in the tribal desert. She was stationed in Delphinium at the time.
I saw it back in Navium. I say, just a bit of it. The letters ALW? The ink was different. She didn't get all 3 letters at once. Initials, perhaps?
Not initials.
Arvatas's eyes light up. Her gen's motto, always victorious. Of course. Look through the death records of Delphinium, I say. There aren't many tattooists in the Empire. Find out if any of those who lived near Delphinium died around that time. She'd have to strip down to get that tattoo, and she'd never leave whoever did it alive. A knock at the door jars me from my plotting. A pale-haired plebeian corporal enters and salutes smartly.
Corporal Favrus, sir, here to deliver the garrison reports.
At the blank look on my face, he goes on. You requested reports from all northern garrisons last month, sir. I remember now. The Corkans around Tiburum were too quiet, and I wanted to know if they were up to something. Wait outside.
I can take the report, Avitas offers. You've a line of men waiting to give you more important information about Marcus's enemies and allies, and an appearance in the yard for some training wouldn't be a bad idea. Take your warhammer. Remind them who you are.
I almost tell him I'm too tired, but then I recall something I heard Quinn Veturius tell Elias once.
When you are weak, look to the battlefield. In battle, you will find your vigor. In battle, you will find your strength.
I can handle intel and a bit of training, I say. You're the only one I trust to find us out, Harper, and quickly. After Karras gets here, everything will become far more difficult. Avitas leaves, and moments later, Favrus is gabbling to me about the Corkans.
They have retreated into the mountains for the most part, Shrike. There has been the occasional skirmish, but nothing unusual. Tiburum has reported nothing more than a few smaller raids on the outskirts of the city.
Details. I'm only half listening to him, as I scan a dozen other things that need my attention. But he doesn't respond. I look up just in time to catch his fleeting look of disquiet, before he describes the skirmishes in bare-bones terms, how many died, how many attacked. Corporal Favrus, I am used to more detailed descriptions, can you tell me which defense maneuvers were successful and which failed, or which clans the Karkans hailed from?
I didn't think it mattered, Shrike. The garrison commanders said the skirmishes were unimportant.
Everything to do with our enemies is important. I hate having to turn centurion on him, but he is a mask and a blackguard. He should know better. What we do not know about the Corkans could be our downfall. We all thought they were crouched around their fires practicing unholy rites with their warlocks, when in fact famine and wars with the south pushed them to build up an enormous fleet that they used to lay waste to our largest port. Favrus pales and nods sharply.
Of course, Shrike, he says. I'll get details on those skirmishes right away.
I can tell he wants to leave, but my instinct tingles. Something strange is afoot, and I've been a mask for too long to ignore the gnawing feeling in my gut. As I observe the corporal, he remains stock still, other than the sweat rolling down the side of his face. Interesting, since my office isn't particularly warm. Dismissed. I wave him away, pretending I haven't noticed his nervousness. I consider it as I make my way to the training yard. When I arrive, the men of the Black Guard, still wary of me, give way. I swing my warhammer and call a challenge. One of the men, an illustrian mask from Gens Raelia, who was here long before I arrived, accepts, and I tuck the issue of Favrus at the back of my mind. Perhaps a good fight or two will rattle some answers loose. It has been so long since I trained. I forgot the way my mind clears when all that is before me is an opponent. I forgot how good it feels to fight those who know how to fight. Masks, trained and true, bonded by the shared experience of surviving Blackcliff. I best the illustrians swiftly, gratified when the men respond to my victory with a huzzah. After an hour, more of the men gather to watch the fights, and after two, I have no challenges left. But I also do not have an answer to the question of Corporal Favrus. I am still mulling it over when a soldier named Alistair crosses the yard. He's one of Harper's friends, a plebeian who has served here in Antium for a dozen years. A good man, and trustworthy according to Dex.
Alistair!
The captain jogs toward me, curious. I've never singled him out before. Do you know Corporal Favrus?
Of course, Bloodstrike. New to the Black Guard. He was transferred from Serra. Quiet. Keeps to himself.
Follow him, I say. I want to know everything about him. No detail is too small. Pay extra attention to his communications with the northern garrisons. He mentioned Karkan's skirmishes, but... I shake my head, uneasy. There's something he's not telling me. After Alistair is dispatched, I find the old Bloodshrike's file on Corporal Favorous. I am wondering at the fact that he appears to be the most boring soldier ever to have entered the Black Guard when my door bursts open to reveal Silvio Aurelius, his dark skin ashen.
"Bloodshrike, sir," he says. "Please, you need to come to the palace. The Emperor, he had some sort of fit in the throne room, started screaming at someone no one else could see, and then he left for the Empress's quarters."
Livia. I am in a frenzy by the time I reach my sister's chambers, where Farris paces outside the door, his footsteps heavy with rage.
"He's inside." His voice is choked. "Shrike! He's not fit! He..."
"Treason, Lieutenant Candolin," I snap. "Skies, doesn't he know the cost of saying such things? There are other guards here who will take his words back to Marcus's enemies. There are scholar slaves who might be in the Commandant's employ. And then where would Livia be? All emperors grow emotional at times. You do not know the weight of the crown. You could never understand. It's rubbish, but the Emperor's Shrike must stand by his side. At least, until I kill him." Livia's pain hits me like a blow to the stomach the moment I enter the room. I am so aware of her, her suffering, her hurt, and beneath that, the steady, quick heartbeat of her child, blissfully unaware of the monster who sits inches from his mother. My sister's face is blanched, and she has one arm laid across her belly. Marcus is sprawled on a chair beside her, trailing his hand up and down the other arm gently, like a lover would. But I notice immediately that Livy's arm doesn't look right. The angle is wrong, because Marcus has broken it. The Emperor lifts his yellow eyes to me.
"Heal her, Bloodshrike," he says. "I'd like to watch you do it."
I do not waste a thought on how much I hate this man. I simply sing Livia's song quickly, unable to bear her pain any longer. Her bones knit together, clean and strong once more.
"Interesting," Marcus says in a dead voice. "Does it work on you?" he asks. "For example, if I demanded your warhammer and shattered your knees right now, would you be able to heal them?"
"No." I lie smoothly, though my insides cringe in disgust. "It doesn't work on me." He tilts his head.
"But if I shatter her knees, you could heal them? With your song?"
I stare at him aghast.
"Answer the question, Shrike, or I'll break her other arm."
"Yes," I say. "Yes, I could heal her. But she's the mother of your child.
She's an illustrian whore you sold to me in exchange for your miserable life," Marcus says. "Her only use is her ability to carry my heir. As soon as he is born, I'll cast her... I'll..."
The suddenness with which his face pales is staggering. He half roars, half screams, his fingers curled into claws. I look to the door, expecting Aurelius and Farris to burst in at the sound of their emperor in pain. They do not, probably because they are hoping that I'm the one causing it.
"Enough!"
He speaks to neither me nor Livia.
"You wanted this! You told me to do it, you!"
Marcus grasps his head, and the moan that comes out of him is animal.
"Heal this!"
He grabs my hand, crushing my fingers, and puts it on his head roughly.
"Heal this!"
I don't...
"Heal it, or I swear to the skies that when the time comes I'll cut my child out of her while she still lives."
He grabs my left hand and slams it to the other side of his head, digging his fingers into my wrists until I hiss in pain.
"Heal me."
"Sit down." I have never wanted to kill someone so much. I wonder suddenly if my healing can be used to destroy. Can I shatter his bones with a song? Stop his heart? Skies, I've no idea how to heal a broken man. How does one heal hallucinations? Is that all that ails him? Does he suffer from something deeper? Is it in his heart, his mind? All I can do is seek his song. I explore his heart first, but it is strong and steady and healthy, a heart that will beat for a long time to come. I circle his mind, and finally step inside. It feels like stepping into a poisoned swamp. Darkness, pain, rage, and a deep, abiding emptiness. I am reminded of Cook, only this darkness is different, more wounded, whereas what lived in Cook felt like nothing at all. I try to soothe the bits of his mind that rage, but it does nothing. I catch a glimpse of something strangely familiar. A wisp of a form, yellow eyes, dark skin, dark hair, a sad face.
He could be so much more, if only he did as I ask.
Zacharias? The words are whispered on the air, but I am not sure who spoke them. Skies, what have I gotten myself into? Help me, I shout in my mind, though to whom I don't know. My father, perhaps? My mother? I don't know what to do.
Stop.
The word is a command, not a request, and even Marcus turns at the sound. For this is a voice that cannot be ignored, not even by the overlord of the Martial Empire. The Nightbringer stands in the middle of the room. The windows are not open, neither is the door. From the terrified look on Livia's face, I can tell that she too is spooked by the djinn's sudden appearance.
She cannot heal you, Emperor,
the Nightbringer says, in his deep, unsettling voice.
You suffer no ailment. Your brother's ghost is real. Until you submit to its will, it will give you no peace.
You. For the first time in what feels like years, Marcus's face holds something other than malice or hatred. He looks haunted.
You knew. Zack said he saw the future in your eyes. Look at me. Look at me. And tell me my end.
I do not show you your end,
the Nightbringer says.
I show you the darkest moment your future holds. Your brother saw his. You will soon face yours, Emperor.
Leave the Shrike. Leave your Empress. Tend to your empire, lest your brother's death be for naught.
Marcus staggers away from the Nightbringer, toward the door. He cuts me a look, enough hate in that glance that I know he isn't yet done with me, and stumbles out. I whirl on the Nightbringer, still shaking from what I saw in Marcus's mind. The same question I asked before is on my lips. What game are you playing? But I do not have to speak it.
No game, Bloodshrike, the djinn says. The very opposite. You will see.
Chapter 34. Elias. We have 12 hours until the marshals arrive. 12 hours to prepare a few thousand tribesmen who are in the worst fighting shape they've ever been in. 12 hours to get the children and injured to safety. If there were any place to run, I would ask the tribes to get the hells away from here. But the sea lies to the east and the forest to the north. The marshals approach from the south and west. Martha pulls at me, the tug getting more painful by the minute. I know I must go back to the forest, but if I don't do something, thousands of tribespeople will be massacred. The waiting place will be filled with even more ghosts. And where will that leave me? The tribes, it's clear, plan to stand and fight. Already the Zaldars, who still have their wits, are readying horses and weaponry and armor. But it won't be enough. Though we outnumber the marshals, they are a superior fighting force. Ambushes in the dead of night with poisoned darts are one thing. But facing an army on a field when your men haven't slept or eaten properly in days.
Banu al-Ma'atha.
Afia's voice is stronger than it was even an hour ago.
The salt works. We still have many deaths to attend to, but the Ru have been released. The spirits no longer plague their families. But there are too many dead now.
Mamie appears behind Afia, pallid and exhausted.
And they must be given burial rites. I spoke to the other Zeldars,
Afia says.
We can muster a force of 1,000 horse.
You don't need to do that, I say. I'm going to take care of it. The Zaldara looks dubious.
Using your magic?
Not exactly. I consider. I have most of what I need, but there is one thing that will make what I must do a bit easier.
Afia,
do you have any of those darts you used during the raids? Mamie and Afia exchange a glance, and my mother steps close enough that only I can hear her. She takes my hands.
What are you planning, my son?
Perhaps I should tell her. She would try to talk me out of it. I know she would. She loves me, and that love blinds her. I extricate myself, unable to meet her eyes. You don't want to know. As I leave the camp, Ma'atha summons me with enough force that I think he will pull me to the forest the way he did after the djinn took me to Lyre. But this is the only way. The first time I killed, I was 11. I saw my enemy's face for days after he was gone. I heard his voice. And then I killed again, and again, and again. Too soon I stopped seeing their faces. I stopped wondering what their names were, or who they left behind. I killed because I was ordered to. And then, once free of Blackleaf, I killed because I had to stay alive. Once, I knew exactly how many lives I had taken. Now I no longer remember. Somewhere along the way, a part of me learned how to stop caring. And that's the part of me that I must draw upon now. As soon as I reason through it in my head, the connection between Ma'atha and me slackens. He offers no magic, but I am able to continue my journey without pain. The martial army stops to camp along the crest of a low plateau. Their tents are a dark stain against the pale desert, their cook fires like stars in the warm night. It takes a half hour of patient observation to figure out where the camp commander is, and another 15 minutes to plan my entrance and exit. My face is known, but most of these people believe I'm dead. They will not expect to see me, and there lies my advantage. The shadows hang thick between the tents, and I let them cradle me as I make my way through the periphery of the camp. The commander's tent is in the center, but the soldiers have erected it hastily, for instead of a clear area around it, other dwellings are staked close by. Access won't be simple, but it won't be impossible either. As I approach the tent, darts ready, a great part of me screams against this.
You will know victory, or you will know death.
I hear the commandant whisper in my ear, an old memory.
There is nothing else.
It's always this way before I kill. Even when I was hunting masks so Lyre could free prisoners from ghost wagons. Even then I struggled. Even then it took its toll. My foes will die, and they will take a bit of me with them. The field of battle is my temple. I draw close to the tent and find a fold that is hidden from anyone inside. Ever so slowly I cut a slit. 5 masks, including the commander, sit around a table within, eating their meal and arguing about the coming battle. They will not expect me, but they are still masks. I will need to move swiftly, before they raise the alarm, which means first taking them out with the darts Afia gave me.
The sword point is my priest.
I must do this. I must cut off the head of this army. Doing so will give the tribes a chance to run. These masks would have killed my people, my family. They would have enslaved them and beaten them and destroyed them. The dance of death is my prayer. But even knowing what the masks would have done, I do not wish to kill. I do not wish to belong to this world of blood and violence and vengeance. I do not wish to be a mask. The killing blow is my release. My wishes do not matter. These men must die. The tribes must be protected, and my humanity must be left behind. I step into the tent, and I unleash the mask lurking within.
Chapter 35. The Bloodshrike. A week after Marcus's attack on Livy, Harper finally emerges from the Hall of Records, where he has spent every waking moment since I gave him his mission. "The record archivists were preparing for a move," he says. "Bloodline certificates and birth records and family trees all over the place. Scholar slaves were trying to clean it up, but they can't read, so it was all a jumble." He places a stack of death certificates on my desk before collapsing into a chair across from me. "You were right. In the past 20 years, 10 tattooists have died unnaturally in and around the cities where the Commandant was posted. One just recently, not far from Antium. The others lived everywhere from the tribal lands to Delphinium. And I found something else." He hands me a list of names. There are 13, all illustrian, all from well-known gens. I recognize 2. They were found dead just recently, here in Antium. I remember reading about them weeks ago, the day Marcus ordered me to Navium. Another name also stands out. "Damon Cassius," I say. "Why do I know that name?" "He was murdered last year in Serra by Scholar's resistance fighters. It happened a few weeks before the murder of a Serran tattooist. Every one of these illustrians was murdered shortly before the local tattooists were. Different cities, different methods, all within the last 20 years. All masks." "I remember now," I say. "Cassius was at home when he was murdered. His wife found him in a locked room. Elias and I were in the middle of the trials when it happened. I wondered how the hells a group of scholar rebels could kill a mask." "Titus Rufius," Harper reads, "killed in a hunting accident at the age of 32, 9 years ago. Eustan Sergius, poisoned at 25. Apparently by a scholar slave who confessed to the crime 16 years ago. Caius Caecilius was 38. He drowned on his family's own grounds, in a river he'd been swimming in since before he could walk. That was 3 years ago." "Avatars, look at their ages." I examine the names carefully. "And they were masks, which means every one of these men graduated with her. She knew them. They all died before they should have, many in unnatural ways. So why? Why did she kill them?" "They got in her way somehow," I say. "She was always ambitious. Maybe they were given postings she wanted, or they thwarted her somehow, or... Oh! Oh!" I remember what Quinn told me of Arius Harper. He was murdered by a group of masks the day after they graduated. Kerris's fellow senior skulls, a vicious killing. More than a dozen of them beat him to death. Illustrian, all of them. "It wasn't because they got in her way," I relate what Quinn said. "It was vengeance. They beat Arius Harper to death." I look up from the scrolls. I wonder if his father had green eyes too. "Your father..." Avitas is quiet for a long moment. "I didn't know how he died." "Bleeding hells." "I'm sorry," I say quickly. "I thought..." "Oh, skies, Avitas, it doesn't matter." He seems to find the window of my office suddenly very interesting. "He's been gone a long time now. Why would it matter if they killed my father? The Commandant isn't the sentimental type." I am startled by how quickly he moves on, and I consider apologizing again, or telling him that if he doesn't want the nature of his father's death made public, I understand. But then I realize that what he needs is for me to move on, to be the Bloodshrike, to let it go. "It's not sentiment," I say briskly, though I have my doubts. "The Commandant did, after all, take Avitas under her wing. inasmuch as someone like her could. It's power. She loved him, they killed him, they took her power. By murdering them, she's taking it back.
How do we use this against her?
We get this information out to the Paters, I say. They learn about the tattoo, the dead tattooists, Arius Harper, the murdered Illustrians, all of it.
We need proof.
We have it. I nod to the death certificates. For anyone who cares to look. If we can get these certificates into the hands of just a few trusted Paters, the rest won't need to see them. Think of how she's handled what happened in Navium. It didn't matter that she lied. All that mattered is that people believed it.
We should start with Peter Cecilius and Peter Rufius, Harper says. They're her closest allies. The other Paters trust them.
For 3 days, Harper and I seed the rumors. And then, when I am in court listening to Marcus arguing with a tribal envoy.
Illustrians from her own year, over a plebeian, can you imagine? But there's no proof, not enough to jail her. But Cecilia saw the death certificates. The link is obvious. You know how that man loathes idle gossip. Besides, the proof is on her body, that vile tattoo.
After a few more days, I sense the change in the air. I feel the Paters distancing themselves from Karis. Some are even outright opposed to her. When she does return to Antium, she will find it a far less welcoming city than she expects. Captain Alistair sends me a message letting me know he has information. On the same day, Dex returns to Antium, and I call them both to me in the training yard.
Karis will be here within the week.
Dex is fresh from the road, splattered with mud, exhausted, but he spars with me anyway, keeping his helm low so that his lips cannot be read. It's nearly impossible to hear him over the clash of weapons and grunts of men training.
She knows you've spread the truth about the tattoo and the murders. She sent two assassins. I dispatched them before they could get here, but Skies know what she'll do when she arrives. You'd best start cooking your food yourself, farming your own grain, too.
Did she ride straight for Antium?
She stopped at the roost, Dex says. I followed her in, but her men nearly caught me. By then I thought it best to get back here. I'll check in with my spies.
Dex's gaze shifts over my shoulder, and he frowns. At the entrance to the barracks, across the training field, a group of black guards crowds together. I think at first that a fight has broken out. I hurry toward them, warhammer still in hand. One of the men calls out,
"Get the bleeding physician!"
"No point. That's carcass snake venom."
They are clustered around a fellow guard, who bucks as he vomits black bile onto the ground. I recognize him instantly. Captain Alistair.
"Bleeding hells!"
I crouch down next to him.
"Get the barracks physician! Get him now!"
But the man could already be here and it would be too late. The black bile, the red mottling around Alistair's nose and ears. It is carcass snake venom. He's done for. Harper pushes through the crowd and kneels beside me.
"Shrike, what?"
"Nothing."
Alistair grabs the front of my fatigues with one hand and pulls me close. His voice is little more than a death rattle.
"Nothing. No attack. Nothing. Shrike. They're nowhere."
His grip goes slack, and he slumps to the ground, dead.
"Burning skies."
"As you were," I say to the men. "Go on."
The men scatter, except for Dex and Harper, who stare down in horror at the dead soldier. I lean down and rest a pile of papers from Alistair's stiff hand. I expect it to be information on Corporal Favorus. Instead, I find reports from the garrisons across the north, straight from the garrison commanders.
"The Karkans have disappeared."
Harper, reading over my shoulder, sounds as mystified as I feel.
"Not a single attack near Tiberium. Nothing in the deep north, not for months. Corporal Favorus lied. The Karkans were quiet."
"The Karkans are never quiet," I say.
This time last year, they were conquering the Wildmen clans. We stopped them in Tiberium. We stopped them in Navium. They lost their fleet. There's a bleeding famine in their southern territories, and a warlock priest whipping them into righteous fury. They should be harassing every village from here to the sea.
Look at this, Shrike. Harper has searched Alistair's body, and he pulls out another scroll.
He must have found it in Favris's things, Harper says. It's in code.
Break the code, I snap. Something is wrong, very wrong. Find me Favris. Alistair's death can't be a coincidence. The corporal is involved. Get messages to the northwestern garrisons. Have them send scouts to check in on the closest Corkin clans. Find out where they are, what they are doing. I want answers by nightfall, Harper. If those bastards are planning an assault on Tiberium, the city may fall. It might already be too late. Dex, my old friend sighs, already knowing that he's about to head back on the road. Head north, I say. Check the passes around the Neverners. They might be pushing for Delphinium. They won't have enough men to hold it, but that doesn't mean they're not stupid enough to try.
I'll send a message through the drums as soon as I know anything, Shrike.
By nightfall, we've had word from even the most far-flung of the western garrisons. The Corkins have completely abandoned their camps in the west. Their caves are empty. Their grazing animals gone. Their few fields and gardens are fallow. They can't possibly be planning an attack on Tiberium. Which means they are gathering elsewhere. But where? And to what end?
Chapter 36. Liar. Lusa offers no explanation as we leave the palace, the only sign of his frustration, the swift clip of his stride. Excuse me, I poke him in the ribs as he winds through streets unfamiliar to me. Your Highness? Not now, he grinds out. As much as I want to question him, we have a bigger problem, which is how the hells we're going to get rid of Captain Aliba. The mariner spoke briefly to the king before escorting us from the throne room, and hasn't been more than a foot away from us since. When Musa enters a neighborhood where the houses are densely packed, I prepare to pull on my invisibility, expecting him to attack our chaperone. But instead, he just stops in an alley.
Well, he says.
Aliba clears her throat and turns to me.
His Royal Highness, King Ermand, thanks you for your warning, liar, and wishes to assure you that he does not take lightly the interference of the fey creatures in his domain. He accepts Darin of Sarah's offer for weapons and vows that he will provide shelter for the scholars in the city until more permanent accommodations can be made. And he wishes you to have this. Aliba places in my hand a silver signet ring, emblazoned with a trident. Show it to any mariner, and they are honor-bound to aid you.
Musa smiles.
I knew you'd get to him.
But the Crown Princess, she...
King Ermand has been ruler in Marin for 60 years,
Aliba says.
Princess Nikla was not always as she is now. The king has no other heir, and he does not wish to undermine her by disagreeing with her outright, but he knows what is best for his people.
All I can manage is a nod.
Good luck, Lyra of Sarah, Aliba says quietly. Perhaps we will meet again.
Prepare your city, I say it before I lose my courage. Aliba raises perfectly arched brows, and I rush on, feeling like an idiot for giving advice to a woman 20 years older and far wiser than I am. You're the captain of the guard. You have power. Please do what you can, and if you have friends elsewhere in the Freelands who can do the same, tell them. When she is long gone, Musa answers my unspoken question.
Nikla and I eloped 10 years ago, he says. We were only a little older than you, but much more foolish. She had an older brother who was supposed to be king, but he died. She was named Crown Princess, and we grew apart.
I wince at the perfunctory nature of his recitation. A decade of history in 4 sentences.
I didn't mention it before because There was no point. We've been separated for years. She took my lands, my titles, my fortune.
Your heart. Musa's harsh laugh echoes off the hard stone of the buildings on either side of us.
That too, he says. You should change and get your things. Say goodbye to Darin. I'll meet you at the East Gate with supplies and information about my contact.
He must see that I'm about to try to offer him a word of comfort, for he melts into the dark quickly. A half hour later, I've gathered my hair in a fat plait and returned the dress to Musa's quarters at the forge. Darin sits with Ture and Zella in the courtyard, soaking a low fire while the two women pack clay onto the edges of a sword. He glances up when I appear, and spotting my packed bag, excuses himself.
I'll be ready in an hour, he says after I tell him of my audience with the king. Best tell Musa to make it 2 horses.
The scholars need you, Darin. And now the mariners need you too. Darin's shoulders stiffen.
I agreed to make weapons for the mariners before I realized you'd be leaving so soon. They can wait. I won't stay behind.
You have to, I say. I must try to stop the Nightbringer. But if I fail, our people need to be able to fight. What is the point of all you suffered, all we suffered, if we don't even give our people a chance in battle?
Where you go, I go, Darin says quietly. That was the promise we made.
Is that promise worth more than the future of our people?
You sound like Mother.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
It is a bad thing. She put the resistance, her people, ahead of everything. Her husband, her children, herself. If you knew,
my neck prickles. If I knew what?
He sighs. Nothing.
No, I say. You've done this before. I know Mother wasn't perfect, and I heard rumors when I was out in the city. But she wasn't what Princess Nicola made her out to be. She wasn't a monster.
Darin tosses his apron on an anvil and begins throwing tools in a sack, stubbornly refusing to talk about Mother. You'll need someone to watch your back, Lyre. Afia isn't there to do it, and neither is Elias. Who better than your brother?
You heard Musa. He has someone who will help me.
Do you know who? Has he given you a name? How do you know you can trust that person?
I don't. But I trust Musa.
Why? You barely know him, like you barely knew Keenan. Excuse me, the Nightbringer. Like you barely knew Mazen.
I was wrong about them. My ire rises, but I quash it. He is angry because he is scared, and I know that feeling well. But I don't think I'm wrong about Musa. He's frustrating, and he gets on my nerves. But he's been honest. And he... We both. We have the magic, Darin. There's no one else I can even talk to about it.
You could talk to me.
After Koff, I was barely able to talk to you about breakfast, let alone magic. I hate this. I hate fighting with him. Part of me wants to give in. Let him join me. I will be less lonely. I will feel less afraid. Your fear doesn't matter, Lyre. Nor your loneliness. The scholar's survival is what matters. If something happens to me, I say, who will speak for the scholars? Who knows the truth about the Nightbringer's plan? Who will ensure that the mariners prepare, no matter the consequence?
Bleeding hells, Lyre! Stop!
Darin never raises his voice, and I am surprised enough that I waver.
I'm coming with you. That's it.
I sigh, because I hoped it wouldn't come to this. And yet I suspected it might. My brother, stubborn as a son. Now I know why Elias left a note all those months ago when he disappeared, instead of saying goodbye. It's not because he didn't care. It's because he cared too much. I'll just disappear, I say. You won't be able to follow me.
Darin glares at me in disgusted disbelief. You wouldn't do that.
I would, if I thought it would keep you from coming after me.
You just expect me to be all right with this, Darin says. To watch you leave, knowing that the only family I have left is risking herself again.
That's rich.
What did you do, meeting with Spiro for all those months? If anyone should understand this, Darren, it's you. My anger takes hold now, the words pouring like poison from my mouth. Don't say it, Lyra. Don't. But I do. I cannot stop. The raid happened because of you. Nan and Pop died because of you. I went to Blackcliff for you. I got this... I yank my collar back to reveal the Commandant's K. Because of you. And I traveled halfway across the bleeding world, lost one of the only true friends I've ever had, and saw the man I love get chained to some hellish underworld because of you. So don't talk to me about risking myself. Don't you bleeding dare. I didn't know how much was locked up inside me until I began shouting it. And now my rage is full-throated and throbbing, tearing out of me. You stay here, I snap at him. You make weapons, and you give us a fighting chance. You owe that to Nan and Pop and Izzy and Elias and me. Don't think I'll bleeding forget it. Darren's mouth hangs open, and I stride out, slamming the forge door behind me. My anger carries me away from the shipyard and up into the city, and when I am halfway to the western gate, Musa falls into step beside me.
Spectacular fight, he jogs to catch up with me, stealthily as a wraith. Do you think you should apologize before you leave? You were a bit harsh.
Is there anything you don't eavesdrop on?
I can't help it if the whites are gossips, he shrugs. Though I was gratified to hear that you finally admitted how you feel about Elias out loud. You never talk about him, you know.
My face heats. Elias is none of your business.
As long as he doesn't stop you from keeping your promise, Arpan, Musa says. I agree. I'll walk you to your horse. There are maps and supplies in the saddlebags. I marked a route straight west, through the mountains. Should get you to the Forest of Dusk in a bit more than 3 weeks. My contact will meet you on the other side and take you to Antium.
We come to the west gate, just as a nearby bell tower chimes midnight. In tune with the last bell tolling, there is a low hiss, a dagger leaving its sheath. As I reach for my own weapon, something zings past my ear. An angry chitter erupts near me, and small hands shove at me. I drop, dragging Musa down as an arrow flies overhead. Another arrow shoots out of the darkness, but it too misses its mark, dropping in mid-air, courtesy of Musa's whites.
Nikla, Musa snarls. Show yourself.
The shadows shift and the crown princess steps out of the darkness. She glares at us balefully, her face barely visible beneath the ghouls swarming all over her. I should have known that traitor Aliba would let you go, she hisses. She will pay. More footsteps approach, Nicholas soldiers closing in on Musa and me. Ever so slowly, Musa puts himself between me and Nikla.
Listen to reason, please. We both know. Don't you speak to me.
The princess growls at Musa, and the ghouls cluck happily at her pain.
You had your chance.
When I rush her, Musa whispers, barely audible. Run.
I'm just processing what he says when he's past me and heading straight for Nikla. Immediately, silver-armored bodyguards step out of the shadows and attack Musa so swiftly that he is now nothing but a blur. I cannot just let Nikla's men take him. Skies know what they will do. But if I hurt any of these mariners, it might turn King Ermond against us. I flip my dagger around to the hilt, but a hand grabs me and yanks me back.
Go, little sister, Darren says,
a staff in his hands. Tore, Zella, and a group of scholars from the refugee camp are at his back.
We'll make sure no one dies. Get out of here. Save us.
Musa, and you, if they arrest you...
We'll be fine, Darren says. You were right. We have to be ready. But we don't have a chance if you don't go. Ride fast, Lyra. Stop him. I'm with you here.
He taps my heart.
Go.
And like that day long ago in Sarah, with my brother's voice ringing in my ears, I flee. For the first 3 days on the road, I hardly stop, expecting at any moment for Nikla and her men to find me. Every possible outcome plagues my mind, an ever-changing play of nightmares.
The mariners overcome Darin and Musa and Zella and Tore. The king sends soldiers to drag me back. The scholars are left to starve. Or worse, they are driven from Edessa, refugees, yet again. But 4 mornings after I leave, I am woken before dawn by a quiet chitter beside my ear. I so associate the sound with Musa that I expect to see him when I open my eyes. Instead, a scroll sits on my chest, with only one word printed on it. Safe. After that, I stop looking over my shoulder and start looking ahead. True to Eliba's word, whenever I stop at a courier station and show the king's ring, I receive a fresh mount and supplies, no questions asked. The help couldn't come at a better time, for I am gripped by desperation. Every day brings me closer to the Grain Moon and to the Nightbringer's victory. Every day makes it more likely that he will find a way to trick the Bloodshrike into giving him the ring, which he'll use to set his wrathful kindred free. As I ride, I pass out the remaining bits of Shaver's prophecy. The line about the butcher worries me, but not as much as the dead will rise, and none can survive. The dead are Elias's domain. If they rise, does that mean they will escape the waiting place? What happens if they do? And what of the end of the prophecy? It makes little sense. All but the ghost will fall, her flesh will wither. The meaning there is disturbingly clear. I'm going to die. But then again, just because it's a prophecy doesn't mean it's written in stone. I encounter many other travelers, but the king's sigil on my saddle and cloak keeps the questions at bay, and I do not invite conversation. After a week cutting through the mountains and 10 days winding down into gentle rolling farmland, the forest of dusk appears on the horizon, a blue line of fuzz beneath flocculent clouds. This far from the major cities, there are no courier stations, and the farms and villages are far apart. But I do not feel lonely. A sense of anticipation builds. Soon I will be reunited with Elias. I recall what I blurted out during my argument with Darin. The man I love. I thought I loved Keenan, but that love was born out of desperation and loneliness, out of a need to see myself, my struggles, in someone else. What I feel for Elias is different. A flame I hold close to my heart when I feel my strength flagging. Sometimes, deep in the night as I travel, I picture a future with him. But I dare not look at it too closely. How can I, when it can never be? I wonder what he has become in the months we've been apart. Has he changed? Is he eating? Taking care of himself? Skies, I hope he has not grown a beard. I hated his beard. The forest transforms from a furred, distant line to a wall of knotted trunks that I know well. Even beneath the noontime shine of a summer sun, the waiting place feels ominous. I leave my horse to graze, and as I draw near the tree line,
a wind rises and the gnarled forest canopy sways.
The leaves sing in whispers, a gentle sound. Elias? The silence is uncanny. No ghosts wail or cry out. Anxiety gnaws at me. What if Elias cannot pass the ghosts through? What if something has happened to him? The stillness of the forest makes me think of a predator stalking in tall grasses, watching its oblivious prey. But as the sun dips west, a familiar darkness rises in me, urging me toward the trees. I felt this darkness with the Nightbringer, long ago, when I sought to get answers out of him. I felt it again after Shaver died, when I thought the djinn would hurt Elias. It does not feel evil, this darkness. It feels like part of me. I step into the trees, tense, blade in hand. Nothing happens. The forest is quiet, but birds still sing, and small creatures still move through the underbrush. No ghosts